Hi, today is February 6, 2016. This is Mobile News Podcast number 148. I'm Todd Ogasawart, my good friend John Westfall, and today we have a mutual good friend, Jason Dunn. Yeah, I think John used to write that for Jason's site for a while, right?
Yes.
Like for a long
while. Yeah, for about 7 years or so. I was there from 2005 until Jason decided to jump out of the blogging business.
Yeah, so.
That's right.
I've known Jason since he was about knee-high. No, not quite that long. But
boy. I don't know. Those old photos, the photo that circulates every so often from 97, 98, Jason does.
How long have we known each other, Jason? From about 98?
Yeah, I think it was 97.
So, 97? Wow. So we're coming up almost 20 years.
That's pretty insane when you think about it.
Yeah, it is. Considering you're only 20 years old now. No. not quite.
No.
Any rate, so Jason and I were among the original, five Microsoft Windows, wasn't Windows CE, it was Windows CE, yeah. It wasn't Windows Mobile yet, Windows CE.
Yeah, Windows CE, yes.
Most Valuable Professionals, which is a more or less an honorary thing. It's not a job. It's not a contract. It's just a recognition, I guess is what you say.
Obviously, yes. Because about 10 years after that, you were less valuable.
That's right.
And we all got kicked out.
That's right. And John Westfall was also, I don't think you were Windows CE MVP, you were Windows Mobile MVP when we were all.
Yeah, I came in just about the time it changed from Pocket PC to Windows Mobile, the formal title.
Yeah. We went through a couple of different name changes. But at any rate, Jason has done a whole bunch of stuff in the mobile space, and we've been wanting to get him on. A lot of scheduling things, but one of the things that many old-timers will remember Jason and John for is the old PocketPCThoughts.com website, which I used to call the Thoughts Media Empire, because you had at one point, I think, four or five websites with the Thoughts branding in it.
Six, actually.
Six. Okay.
Yes.
And I just want to tell, I mentioned this to Jason email when we were talking about this podcast or getting together for this podcast, is I think his was the first blog I ever saw. When I saw PocketPCThoughts.com, I said, hey, he's just got it in reverse chronological order. He's not trying to arrange it by topic or anything. I said, that's a great idea. I didn't even know what a blog was at the time.
Yeah, the first version of the site was on Blogspot. You guys remember the old Blogger, platform? And so it was
before it got bought by Google.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. It's when it was its own thing, and it was your classic startup with, underpowered servers. So when there was a surge of traffic, everything would just collapse and fall apart, and it's classic.
The funny thing about that old infrastructure is that occasionally if you watch when you log into Google, you'll see in the URL as they're passing you through authentication layers names of old services like that.
Yeah.
So when you log into, I think, Google Sites, it still talks about JotSpot, which they bought.
Oh, I miss JotSpot.
Yeah, so it's really kind of funny. That's really the only place you find some of those old platforms anymore is in the ghosts of their former pieces.
I'm sorry, JotSpot? Is this a place for men in tight underwear? What is this?
Jot. J-O-T spot.
Jot.
It was one of the first wikis, right, as I recall? Or wiki-like system. So what happened? So Pocket PC Thoughts ran for how long, Jason? It was a good long run.
It was a good long run, yeah. I mean, Pocket PC Thoughts eventually became Windows Phone Thoughts, right, when Microsoft did drop Pocket PC and transition to Windows Phone. But really, all the sites were active until 2012.
Wow.
So Pocket PC Thoughts launched in, was it 97 or was it 99? Because I think it was 99, because in 97 I had the Windows CE FAQ.
I remember that one.
Propped up some little sites prior to that, and then I got real serious when I got my own domain name. So, yeah.
And the sites, unlike many other from that era, the sites are still online, I should mention.
Are they?
They're not taking new content, and they're not, I don't know, are the forums working, Jason, or is it just the site, the content up?
Everything is up. The forums have been turned off, but they're still browsable. Mm. And that has been, as John could personally attest to, I'm very stubborn, and I didn't want to let them go. There's so many amazing volunteers and contributors in the community, right? There's just tens of thousands of fantastic posts and all this great content. And I have this, maybe it's wistful or unrealistic view that once something is online, it should just stay there forever. I think it's like it's part of the knowledge that the internet represents.
Yeah.
And so since 2012, I continued to pay for the dedicated server that was getting almost no use. Like $100 a month, actually.
Wow.
For the past, so literally thousands of dollars sort of down the drain. But I didn't want to let them go.
No,
and it was only actually pretty recently that I moved to a more affordable platform.
Well, you know,
I think there's a lot to that idea of sort of having, I mean, you weren't in essence wasting $100 a month. You were keeping a collection. You know, yes. Collectors.
An extensive collection.
Yeah, collectors would talk about the same thing if it was a physical collection of maintenance fees and, you know, humidity control and all that. You just were keeping a server running.
Yeah, I think it from a historical point of view, because you started essentially right after Windows CE launched, it's a really a vast historical trove of knowledge and, you know, discussions that should anybody care to go back to it. And, you know, I actually want to go back to some of my old articles on some sites I published on, not my own, but, you know, that I wrote for. And they're gone now, right? Including Microsoft. Even Microsoft.com didn't preserve our old stuff, which would be, for me anyway, historically interesting.
Yeah, that's the thing, right? There's so many websites, especially content sites, that are just, you know, how often do you click on a link and it just goes to a 404, they redirect you to the homepage.
Right.
I think a lot of websites, and, you know, in my day job at AT&T, you know, I help run a content website, and I understand the pain of like, oh, God, we got to change this and move this, and, you know, do we go through the work to do these redirects? And sometimes people don't think it's important, I think it is.
It is.
In fact, even the Windows CE FAQ or the... Remember the Philips Velo, that little clamshell
device? I still have one, I think.
I have one on the shelf, too. My original Velo FAQ is still online, too. Wow. At jasondunn.com, I have an archives link.
Yeah.
And every website I ever made, including like Cyrano de Bergerac and a Tom Jones website, everything I've ever done is online.
Wow, literary stuff.
Yeah, that's right.
Okay. Yeah, anyway, I just wanted to thank you because, you know, even though... I'm an old guy and you are a young guy. You are really pioneering stuff that I had never seen before. And it's like the blog, the discussion groups, the kind of aggregation of other people to help you out, like John and Ed and a whole bunch of our other friends. It was really an amazing enterprise, and I really admired your work on there. And I read it every day. So thanks for
that. Thank you. Yeah, thank you. But again, it was such a great team effort. You know, I think that was the one of the interesting things, right? You know, now we toss around, you know, terms like UGC and, you know, people are all, you know, co-contributing. But back in the, you know, late 90s, it was a strange kind of business model, right?
And, right. I'd never heard of anything like it.
Well, in a way, it's very much like the academic publishing model. You know, the idea that, you know, professors like myself write the articles, other professors peer review the articles, other professors edit the articles, and then a journal makes a bunch of money and doesn't pay us anything.
Oh, forgot the other professors to criticize the articles.
Yeah, other professors criticize the articles. So in a sense, academia has been doing this for years, this very dysfunctional idea that content is free. But it is amazing, I think, looking back at Thoughts Media, that for so long we had, I think, very good content from volunteers.
Yeah,
and I think that's one of the things that, you know, I carry forward with me to this day is the power of community and the power of people that care about something.
Yeah.
They'll go to extreme lengths, you know, and create amazing stuff. And that's why I think I felt so passionately about not letting the sites go away, because I feel like I'm like a curator of a museum, and all that great, the articles and reviews and, you know, Janik's, you know, 300-page review of like a Palm Trio, you know, or Pocket PC Trio, you know, it's all this amazing stuff. And even if, you know, only 5 people a year, you know, happen to stumble across that, I think it's great work that shouldn't be swept under the rug.
Yeah. You know, and every now and then I'm trying to look for one of my own articles as a reference point for something I'm writing now, and I can't find it. It's really upsetting. So
yeah,
I'm glad you are keeping your stuff and your contributor stuff alive. And so moving on, you know, after Pocket PC, I think, did you go to HTC? I think you kind of slowed down Pocket PC Thoughts because you moved to HTC at the time. Is that right?
Yeah. So it was in 2011, kind of end of 2011 was when I moved from Canada down to the US and I joined HTC, and the sites essentially just went into hibernation. There was still a little bit of posting. I was trying to figure out what to do with them. I mean, honestly, for a while, a long while, I was actually trying to sell them. There was one point I got to like the contracting phase and I dragged my feet a little bit and lost out on that. And then, I started HTC, and then there was really no more time. And some of the other sites, like, you know, Android Thoughts that John was running, and Apple Thoughts that Vinny was running, and later Jeff, they continued for a little while. And then just came to the point where I couldn't play that kind of editor-in-chief coordination role. And so we just decided to kind of, as a group, just shut them down and put them in, you know, carbonite, like Han Solo.
Yeah.
Carbon freezing.
Yeah. Well, with HTC life a little bit behind you now, can you talk about how you see it today? I mean, at one point, to me, HTC was the great phone company, phone hardware manufacturer company. I think they made stuff for, I think the Compact Pocket PC Phone Edition might have been an HTC.
Yep. The first compacts were, I mean, yeah, you know, HTC, for those that don't, you know their history, right? They started as an ODM, right? And an OEM, and they, you know, white labeled stuff, you know, so they would make things for Compaq at the time, or, you know, iMate and all these other brands that people might know a little bit better back then. And they essentially eventually transitioned into making their own devices. And at the time, everyone told them it was, you know, suicidal. No one knew who they were as a brand. It was a ridiculous thing for them to try to do. And they made that transition and, you know, made it stunningly successfully. I mean, they helped really make Android what it was. If you look at the very first versions of Android, it was a couple steps up from DOS, right? And no slight against the Android team back then, but HTC was the first company to really make a usable skin on it. And that's where you get HTC Sense. Mm-hmm. And when I joined HTC, actually in Q4 of 2011, at the time in the US, they were the number one smartphone manufacturer. They outsold Apple, they outsold Samsung.
I didn't know that.
That was the top of the mountain. And then after I joined, it was kind of downhill from there. So maybe it was all my fault.
Oh, my gosh. You're the one.
It's all my fault.
Yeah, we really shouldn't say that, or else hundreds of shareholders will descend on Jason's house at this very moment.
Exactly. But it was really interesting to me because, as you said, you know, it's not just Android, the Windows Mobile, Windows Phone stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
I had a series of HTC phones, both the smartphone without the touchscreen as well as the touchscreen and, you know, Pocket PC Phone Edition type devices. I think almost everything I had was HTC. I'm trying to think if I had any non-HTC phones, and I'm kind of coming up short to think of what they might be. My last Windows phone was the HTC HD7, I think, which was a great Windows phone. It was the first and my last Windows phone.
Yeah, I mean, again, HTC, you know, we talk, you know, we go back to the Windows CE and the Pocket PC days. I mean, you know, and then when HTC started doing their own stuff, I mean, they did some amazing designs. Yeah. You know, you think about some of the classic devices like that soft touch rubber, you know, and some of the early like keyboard devices. I mean, they just had amazing, you know, industrial design. And they still do, you know. I mean, HTC devices, regardless of you know, which one you're looking at, they're always, you know, beautiful, well-made devices.
Yeah, very holdable.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Which, you know, some people might say, well, aren't all phones holdable? And the answer is no. Some are just a giant pain to try to hold comfortably in your hand.
Yeah. Yeah, and in fact, I always had a thing where I always felt HTC phones were so beautiful. And again, you know, obviously I'm biased. You know, I was working for them for almost 3 years, but I would never put them in a case because I'm like, this is gorgeous. This is a piece of art. I don't want to hide this in a case.
Actually, you know, I don't think I put any of my HTC phones in a case either. I don't know why. But they were just so comfortable in my hand. I just didn't want to, like, ruin that experience, I guess, you know.
Yeah.
So what was your last Windows phone, regardless of brand? Mine, like I said, mine was the HD7.
Yeah, so I guess my last Windows phone would actually be because when I was working at HTC, HTC was making Windows phones still, you know, a couple of years ago. So it would have been the 8X.
I remember that. I didn't have one, but I remember it. Yeah.
Yeah. Again, you know, beautiful devices. There was another phone called the 8S, which I actually liked a little bit more because it had this gorgeous kind of two-tone design where the body was one color and then the top kind of, I think the end with the antenna bar was a different color. It never really got picked up in the US, but it was a smaller phone. It was just gorgeous and fun. Like, it was a really, really fun device. And that was one of the first devices that had the wide angle front-facing camera. It was like, I think it was 100 and, well, I want to say it was 180 degrees of view, but it was great because you could take a selfie with it and actually see the whole background. You could actually see where you were. It was a great phone.
That's unique even today.
It is, actually. There's not many people doing it. Yeah.
So looking back now, with a few years between you and HTC, you really don't hear much about HTC anymore. I think they've got like a camera, the RE. But I don't really hear about their phones anymore.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting, right? Coming from a PR background, that's what my original kind of training is in. You think a lot about mindshare, right? And it's really interesting when you look at the way the press talks about smartphones. When you stop being name dropped in our articles when people are talking about smartphone manufacturers, you know that you're in a precarious position, because if you're not front of mind, and if someone's, there's just an average journalist or blogger writing an article about smartphones and he's, typing up Motorola and LG and whatever, if you're not on that list, it's a very precarious place to be, regardless of what your sales are. But, sales and mindshare are pretty close together. So HTC is still in the mix on the smartphone side, but obviously they've been struggling significantly, as a company. They did some cuts. I think that they're clawing their way back to profitability. But now, if you Google HTC, you're going to see HTC Vive and their VR. That's really what's getting all their headlines now, is all their virtual reality work.
That's true. I've heard some of that in some podcasts.
Yeah.
So what do you see, Jason, as the future for HTC?
Well, if I had to put on my speculation hat, I think that they'll actually spin VR off into a different company. Mm. I think that... just based on the momentum that HTC has with VR, and really, a lot of things happen right in clusters, right? The technology has to mature to a certain point, and then kind of everyone executes upon it, right? So whether it's, Magic Leap or, Oculus, Oculus VR or, HTC Vive, the technology is finally there that you're going to see a bunch of executions. And there's all these rumors about, Apple snapping up VR companies and AR companies. You got Microsoft with a HoloLens. So I think that would probably be what HTC would do. They would actually spin off, the Vive into its own brand. I don't know if the other things will come along for the ride. HTC had the Re, which is this little camera.
Yeah. Oh, you've actually got one.
Of course, this is a podcast. You can't see it, but I'm holding up a Re here.
Looks like a little periscope.
It's like a little periscope. It's honestly, it's a fascinating concept, because who would think of doing a camera without a screen, right? So the Re doesn't have a screen. You just point, you take a picture, and it's got a significantly wide-angle lens that, as long as you're relatively aiming it in the right direction, you're gonna get the image. Now, that came out, over a year ago, and there hasn't been a new one. And, are they going to do it again? But they also just announced... their product with Under Armour. So they have this whole kit. It's like a scale. I think it's a smart tracker. And then there's some other sort of a fitness tracker. So HTC's future started changing well over a year ago, and they're less of a smartphone company and, more of a connected devices company. So their future may be in that place, because the truth is the smartphone space is brutal. It is hard to make money there. Yeah, Samsung and Apple, right? They're the only ones making money.
Yeah, even Samsung is having some hard time. I mean, they're selling a lot, but they're not making a lot of profit.
Exactly. Yeah.
And even Apple, if you've looked at their stock market price is any indication, they've lost, I think, nearly half their value in the last couple of months.
It's a big number, yeah. Because I do own a little bit of Apple shares, and I am always stunned. But the market's irrational. I think of the stock market as a 3-year-old child. Irrational, it screams and yells.
I think that's giving the stock market too much too much credibility.
You're right. It would be a drunk 3-year-old child.
Yeah, there you go. Okay, so that brings us to today. And in the old days, if you ever ran into Jason, you'd see him with a Windows phone or Windows mobile smartphone of some kind, and maybe a Windows Ultra Portable, and you had some kind of high-end desktop. So what are you using today as a phone, notebook, tablet, whatever?
So 2 days ago, I was using an HTC A9. Uh-huh. So that's the HTC phone that came out just a couple months ago. And it was a gorgeous phone. This was the phone that HTC caught a lot of flack for it looking too much like an iPhone. And it certainly had similarities. You know, if you kind of put them two side by side, you would be like, yeah, that looks a lot like an iPhone. But in my mind, there's only so many ways you can design a small slab. You know, that there are certain, you know, they're all going to look similar. But, you know, HTC had a very specific thing. They didn't give it a giant battery. It was really slim and really slender. And it was at a price point, I think, that was sort of like someone who was interested in an iPhone from like a hardware perspective and having a beautiful product, but they didn't want to splash out, you know, $700-$800 for an iPhone. So I used that for a while, and it was a gorgeous phone. The phone I'm using right now, I actually can't talk about.
Oh, so. Okay. Well, maybe you can tell us in a couple of months when you can tell us and come back and
yes.
tell us
yes.
what you're hiding beneath the camera view and tell us why at that point. But at any rate,
okay. My question, I do have a little bit of a phone question though. So I don't know what phone you're using now. I think our listeners could probably infer the brand of that phone, but we're not going to say anything about that. However, if you were to say have to make a jump to one of those big two, Samsung or Apple, which would you go to?
Yeah, that's interesting because, you know, HTC, right, for the longest time, you know, Samsung was, you know, kind of the arch nemesis, right? You know, they were the two brands slugging it out in the Android space. And, you know, it's like any two companies, you know, Samsung was like the bad guy and HTC, you know, we were the good guys. And so, you know, there's a lot of loyalty there still. Every so often, I still use the hashtag on Twitter, I bleed green. You know, that's the kind of loyalty to HTC. And I never got a tattoo or anything, but I still feel a ton of loyalty to the company.
Does happen, you should seek medical attention. You are bleeding green, so, you know, we'll hope it's in the metaphorical sense.
Yes, well, I didn't want to be like, remember that guy that got the Zune tattoo?
Yes, I do remember that.
For people that don't know, we had a Zune Thoughts was part of the Thoughts Media Empire, as Todd said. And we talked a lot about the Zune guy. Although I think at the time I was like, I don't want to talk about this guy because he's clearly just seeking attention. But anyway,
possibly
yes.
Mentally disturbed.
Yeah. Exactly. And then, of course, he got more attention when he got it, I think, lasered off, you know, six months later.
Yeah.
So, yeah, a little bit disturbed. But what would I use? I probably would not necessarily get a Samsung. You know, I think LG is doing some interesting stuff. I've certainly, you know, I like what Motorola is doing. But it may honestly, if I wasn't using an HTC, it probably might just be like a Nexus, like a 6P or something.
Yeah.
I like the idea of the Nexus phones. And certainly, you know, Google has some great, you know, hardware partners that put out some nice hardware. But I don't think I could get myself to use an iPhone, which is funny because I use my iPad constantly, and we're doing this Skype call, you know, on my new iMac, which is maybe something we'll talk about later. So, but for phones, I like Android. I still do.
Yep.
Okay. And and that's the other thing. I was surprised when a while back I saw you got an iPad. I thought, what? Who is this guy? So, which iPad did you get? And you sound like you really like it in the various posts I've seen from you.
Yeah, you know, so for those that don't know, you know, my background, like you guys do, you would have seen me, you know, rail against Apple products for years. I mean, I was the original like Apple hater guy. There was just, you know, overhyped, overpriced, not enough choice, you know, for, you know, coming from, you know, kind of the Microsoft world, like a lot of us, you know, did back then. At the time, you know, I was a big believer in the let 1,000 flowers bloom, you know, concept, right? You build a platform, you let other companies innovate on that platform and create choice and opportunity and options for people. And for a long time, you know, I believed in that. And to a certain degree, I still do. But that only works if people know how to raise a flower properly and they know how to, you know, breed it and water it and feed it. And a lot of OEMs and people making this stuff, they're more concerned about, you know, making 100 flowers a year than making six and making them right. I'm really stretching this analogy, but you know what I mean, right?
Or making very exploitable flowers, flowers that go out and, you know, destroy other flowers. Bring back as much money and pollen as possible.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. So I think the very first Apple device I got was actually an iPod Touch.
Ah.
And so this has got to be going back 6 or 7 years
Me
now.
Too, by the way. That was my first.
So I think for a lot of us, right, it was kind of like, now for me, and I'd love to hear what your first Apple device was and why you got it. But at the time, I wanted to understand the whole app thing. because, you know, coming from like a, you know, Pocket PC and Windows Mobile, you know, our phones, you know, had apps, right? You went to Handango or you'd, mm-hmm. you'd put over the cab file and you'd install it. And it's like, well, we have apps. What's everyone make a big deal about all these apps for? And so I wanted to understand the whole Apple ecosystem because I didn't fully get it. And I don't think you can get it until you're holding their device and you open up the App Store and you click it and you install it and you're like, well, that was easy. You know, like that worked really well, you know. So that's kind of where I first started. But what about you guys? What were your first devices?
Yeah, why don't you start, John?
My first Apple device was an iPod Video back in 2005, 2006. Mm-hmm. I was looking for my first kind of grown-up MP3 player. And so that was what I got. And then, but really, I used that for a little bit. And then I had a Zune for a little while and then kind of back and forth here and there. The first modern sort of Apple device I got was an iPod Touch. It was the second gen iPod Touch.
Yeah, for me it was the iPod Nano, the white one, and I had a couple of different MP3 players, but none of them were quite big enough, and the UI was just terrible. And so I said, "Well, people seem to like this iPod thing. I'll go give it a try," and I liked it. But like you and John, Jason, my first computer kind of or mobile computer kind of thing from Apple was the iPod, first generation iPod Touch. In fact, I bought one for myself and one for my daughter, who was very young at the time, because I just didn't understand the iPhone concept yet. You know, I just couldn't figure out spending like six. I don't think there was a subsidy at that point. I think it was like $600.
No, yeah,
which was an enormous amount of money for a phone to me that had, you know, limited use, but.
And just thinking about it, the reasons I bought the iPod Touch, this is when I first moved to New York, and some of the apps I wanted to use and use for exploring the city were only on iOS at that time. Mm-hmm. So even at that point, the reason I even started looking beyond Android and beyond Windows Phone was the apps.
Yeah, it's interesting.
Well, it's funny, you know, just as a small aside here, there was, thinking back right to, you know, the Windows CE and Pocket, you know, PC devices there was a team at Microsoft at the time that was actually working on like an on-device app store that was going to ship on every single, you know, Windows device, because at the time, you know, you had to go to like Handango, you know, install their thing, and then, but they wouldn't have the app, and it wasn't simple, right? And there was a team that was doing this. And like so many other good ideas at Microsoft, it went through a reorg. It got assigned to some obscure team, and it never went anywhere. And then a year later, you know, Apple had the App Store. And I remember talking to one of the guys at the time that worked on that team, and he was just so depressed because he's like, you know, we could have done this,
yeah,
right? But we weren't able to pull it off. And so, you know, like many other things, Microsoft's timing mm-hmm. is one of their biggest struggles.
In fact, I think I still have a Windows Mobile device, not a phone. Well, maybe it is a phone. Yeah, I think I still have a Windows Mobile phone-type device, you know, with a touchscreen that has Windows Store beta release on it, which, you know, never went into production. And this was before Apple, and I remember thinking, well, this is a pretty good idea. I wonder if, you know, whatever happened to it. And then Apple came out, well, never mind.
Well, it was a pretty good idea. But I think a lot of the power users at the time sort of shunned it and said, well, I'll just install it. You know, it's so much easier. I'll just plug it in. These cab files, I have my collection of cab files on an SD card.
Yeah.
It takes 5 seconds to install everything. Why do I need a stupid app store?
Yeah.
And unfortunately, Microsoft has always kind of looked at things from the power user perspective and the geek perspective and not the mainstream consumer perspective. Yeah. And I have a feeling that they were like, yeah, this is junk. Why do we bother with this stuff? People will just install it off our third-party platforms.
Or it may have been a partnership thing too. You know, maybe they didn't want to annoy Handango and Digital River. I think it was Digital River or something, because I remember I bought something from them and they downloaded the wrong thing and then they wouldn't like let me download the right thing.
Yeah.
I think it was Handango, and then wasn't it Pocket Gear was the competitor to Handango?
Yeah, there were a few in there.
Yeah.
But Todd, back to your original question, how did we sort of, because you asked me about my iPad. So I went, you know, iPod Touch. play with it for a little bit. You know, I'm like, okay, you know, I kind of get this. I kind of get this. But, you know, still was very, you know, very committed, you know, to the Microsoft camp. And then the first iPad came out. And I think like a lot of people, you know, first I made fun of the name, right?
Yeah.
And then I was like, man, like what is it? Like, it's basically John iPod Touch. Like what would I use that for? And I, you know, didn't get it and kind of ignored it. And then the second gen iPad came out. And I'm like, you know, I should check this out. You know, it's kind of interesting. And I got it. And for the first, I think maybe the first month or so, I didn't really know what to do with it. And I think that was a lot of people when they got tablets. Like, there's some people that naturally gravitated towards a tablet and it made sense. And a lot of other people, they're just like, well, what do I do with this? You know, like I have my phone, I have my computer. This third screen was like a mystery. They didn't know what to do with it. And then I just sort of started, I think like a lot of things, it's not useful to you until you really lean in. You know, you got to put your email on there. You got to set up Evernote. You got to install some apps. And then once you start using it, I was like, oh, now I get it. Because I think even now, I'm not one of these people that carries my phone with me everywhere. A lot of the times my phone is, you know, sitting in my office or kind of at my back door. My iPad is what I carry with me everywhere. Because if I'm going to consume content or even, you know, create content or do something on it, the bigger screen, more storage, you know, easier to type on. Like for me, that makes sense. But there's other people to this day that don't care about tablets, but that's because they have their phone glued to their hand. So I think you're kind of either a tablet person or a phone person, and the tablet usability will, you know, depend on what kind of person you are.
Yeah, and of course, now that the phablets are so popular.
Absolutely, yeah, there's a lot of people that, yeah, they might not even need a tablet anymore. I still think, you know, for me, a 10-inch, you know, tablet is still much, much easier to do things on than even a 6-inch device. But John, he went full
gigantic
iPad, right?
I've got, yeah. So
because we're amateurs, he's a pro.
I don't get to fall into either the phone person or the tablet person in that I do carry my phone with me pretty much everywhere, but I also have an iPad mini that sits by my bedside that I use for reading at night when I want a little bit bigger screen. And my work bag has an iPad Pro that I use in meetings for taking notes and when I'm working around campus, and an iPad Air 2 that I use when I present in class. So I, on my given day, I carry a bag with three iOS devices.
Now, and John, you should be using a Kindle. Well, I'm surprised, the whole blue light thing, that makes it hard to sleep.
Yeah, but I've never fallen into the same traps with sleeping that other people do. I can drink a bunch of caffeine and then go straight to sleep. Blue light doesn't seem to bother me. So when I am determined on sleeping, no physiological thing will keep me from it, apparently.
You know, it's funny because talking about the iPad, when I first got the iPod Touch, I remember one of the first things I thought is, if this thing were a lot bigger, it'd be more useful.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Well, and so, talking about the original iPad, I bought an original iPad at launch. I used it on and off, couldn't quite figure out how to use it, and it sat for a good 4 months of that year just in my closet. Yeah. I had no idea what to do with it. Then I ended up selling it about 2 weeks before the iPad Air or the iPad 2 was announced. So I got, I think, almost all my money back for it because it still had pretty high resale. And it wasn't really until the iPad 2 that I started figuring out how to even use a tablet in my daily life so that it was a productive thing.
I have a slightly funny Apple story. So when the iPad Pro was just a rumor, but, you know, it's funny. Apple's gotten worse and worse at keeping secrets. Now, you guys have noticed this, right? Like, they're terrible at it now. But at the time,
they let out the secrets they want out.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. But they had announced, or there was rumors about the iPad Pro. I was on an airplane with my iPad 2. Like, that's kind of my go-to device on an airplane. And about two or three rows in front of me, there was this guy with this iPad, and I'm just like, man, that looks really big. I'm like, is that the iPad Pro? I'm looking at, you know, and it was, you know, maybe, I don't know, 15 feet away, so I couldn't quite judge the screen size, but I'm like, looking at my iPad Air 2 and looking at his, and I'm like, man, like, it looks bigger, it looks heavier, and it took me about 5 minutes before I realized it was just like a first-gen iPad, and they're so big and clunky. It wasn't an iPad Pro at all, but, you know, it's amazing how they've continued to evolve, but yeah. It's interesting, right? You know, people keep, you know, talking about the collapse of tablets, and especially, you know, with the iPad. And it's interesting to see what Apple will do because, like you said, Todd, you know, everyone's buying phablets. And if you have a, you know, a 5.5-inch iPhone, you don't necessarily feel the need for maybe an iPad mini. But I hope iPads stay around for a long time because we're like, we have four iPads in our family. And like, I never thought I would be the guy that would say I have four iPads in my family. I'm definitely going to be buying the iPad Air 3 when it comes out because I use my iPad Air more than any other computing device that I have.
Wow.
And so even if it's incrementally improved, to me, that'll be a big deal. And then I resell my old iPads usually to family members. So it's like this sort of slowly growing iPad thing, this iPad empire, I guess.
And from a family perspective, it's much easier to manage a family of iPads and iOS devices than Android devices, just device management-wise.
Yeah, and, you know, God, Android and tablets, that's a whole other rant right there, right? Yeah. Boy.
Yeah, that there really aren't any Android tablets, right? There are tablets running Android phone systems on them. They're not really designed for the tablet yet, I think, having bought a couple of them myself.
Yeah, and a lot of it are the apps, but it's also interesting, too, to see the criticisms that have been levied against, you know, the iPad Pro, right?
Yeah.
That the bigger bigger you make the screens, this phone operating system starts to be more and more ridiculous. It's gotten certainly better with the side-by-side apps, and you can see Apple has obviously made some attempts to address that. But I know, John, I'd be interested, do you ever look at your iPad Pro and just go, wow, this is really a phone operating system?
Oh, definitely on the springboard. Definitely looking at just the misuse of that screen. I definitely agree with Janik when he rants about this sort of stuff on Twitter. But in looking at the apps, so once I'm in... So, for example, that's one of the devices I use Microsoft Outlook for iOS quite a bit on. The apps, I think, do a fine job with the screen real estate, but Apple needs to do something with the navigation interface so that it makes better use of that giant screen.
Right. Okay. And I have a quick funny story. John has heard this story a million times, but it's since we're telling Apple stories. And we're talking about the iPad. So when the first iPad came out, I was a full-time blogger. And I pre-ordered my iPad the night it became available and was anxiously awaiting for it to be delivered to me on, I think it was April 4th, 2010, which was a Saturday. And then on April Fool's Day.
What was the weather there?
It was very nice.
The birds were chirping.
On April 1st, which was like a Tuesday, I get an email from UPS saying, hey, we're very sorry. We know that you have an iPad. We have an order for you from Apple that's supposed to be delivered on Saturday, but we do not have Saturday delivery in Hawaii, so you will not be receiving your iPad. And of course, now I depend on this for a living, right? I write full time, trying to get. So I'm like, what? Maybe this is just a joke, right? It's April Fool's. Maybe it's just spam. I'm not looking at the headers correctly, but the headers look awfully authentic to me. So then I get an email from Apple, in the account that I use with them saying, hey, you know, we know you pre-ordered, but we were told by UPS that, and so no one in Hawaii will be getting their iPads on Saturday if you pre-ordered it to be delivered by mail. So I don't know what to do. I'm not rich enough to just go buy another one and, hopefully sell the second one off or something like that. So I'm just kind of not figuring out what to do at this point. So I'm thinking about April 2nd. I send an email off to Steve Jobs, steve@apple.com. And I'm very polite. Says, I'm a long time, blah, blah, blah. I bought all this stuff. And, I'm not a fly-by-night customer. And I feel that, we were promised delivery on the 4th and blah, blah, blah. And I said, okay, nothing's going to happen, but I got it off my chest. Even if nobody reads it, I said something, right? I think the next morning, which would be like Thursday, my wife was normally at work, was home that day. I don't know if she's waiting for something to be delivered or whatever, but she was working at home that morning. She calls me at my office saying, hey, you got a call from Steve Jobs' office.
What?
Yeah. So I gave them your work number. You might be expecting a call from them. A couple minutes later, I get a call from this guy. I forget his name. He says, hi, I'm so-and-so, calling from the office of Steve Jobs. We understand you're having a problem with your order, and we'd like to fix this.
Wow.
Yeah. And so what they did for me was they said, well, what can we do? And I said, well, I am happy to stand in line on Saturday morning at the local Apple store if you can get me a pre-order. But at this point, I myself cannot pre-order an Apple iPad and go pick it up. This is, well, let me see. And so he says, can I call you back? I says, yes. 10 minutes later, he calls me back. And he says, this is what we've done. Go to this Apple store, stand in line. When they come through with their little, people with a little checkbox thing, tell them who you are. Tell them the name of this person at the store, and they will take care of you. So I go stand in line with hundreds of people. This is back when lines were a thing. I'm standing in line. Sure enough, an Apple store employee comes out, starts checking off people, giving people tags and numbers, you know, which one are you getting and all this. And I say, look, I'm sorry, I don't have a, you know, pre-order number for you, but this is my, I was told to give you my name and ask for this person in the store. And so she looks at me, she comes back. Another person comes and says, okay, we know who you are. Don't worry, you're taken care of.
Wow.
Yeah. So, It was a quite an interesting adventure that week. And talk that about was. Customer service, right? That's, I mean, that is just amazing. Yeah,
that's amazing. That's fantastic. I don't know if you won the lottery, if they, you know, respond to one out of every 1,000 emails that you get back then or something.
It is amazing, though, because a couple of weeks ago I was watching one of the interviews that Tim Cook had done where he had brought up, as he's been doing in the last few years, bringing up the fact of different populations and being a role model. Ever since he came out of the closet, he's been, you know, subtly throwing that into a lot of what he talks about and saying, look, that's why I came out, even though I value my privacy, etc. And just in a moment, you know, kind of thinking not in my geek mindset, but in my psychologist mindset, I wrote him an email and said, you know, I just want to thank you for being an advocate for people who are struggling with this sort of stuff. Thanks for giving up some of your personal privacy. And I said, I think this is the most, you know, important thing you've probably done in your life, even though you've done a lot of other technological things. And I got a reply back about 3 hours later from his iPad Pro saying, oh, thanks, you know, et cetera, like a one-line reply. So it's crazy how you can kind of mock Apple in a lot of ways, but they do, it seems, at least on the surface, try to live up to some of the things they espouse.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, so a couple of news items before we sign off. Jason, feel free to jump in if anything interests you. I read yesterday that Google is now partnering with somebody called Editions at Play, or maybe that's the name of the book, the book type. And they're calling it unprintable books, which are basically in a multimedia. There's like Street View kind of stuff involved in a narrative. I'll put the link on it to BuzzFeed in the blog that accompanies this thing. But
yeah, you know, see, I love your source on this.
I BuzzFeed?
This is the first time we've ever used BuzzFeed as a source.
I have to say, well, they were the first ones I saw printing it, so I gave them credit. But it's, you know, the thing that I found interesting. I mean, it's always interesting to see this, but really, it's not the first unprintable book. I mean, you know, I remember people doing magazines on CDs. If you guys are old enough to remember that, that didn't work. I remember Apple just a few years ago tried to publish or promote books by other people in a multimedia format. I bought a Beatles book, for example, that is also a guitar tutorial. So it has some Beatles history on individual songs, and there's tutorials, and you can click on different sheets of music, and it'll demonstrate it for you with text to go along. So it's not certainly the first to do it. I don't know. I'm just debating whether to spend a couple of bucks to buy one of these unprintable books.
It's interesting, right? Because, you know, fundamentally, in my mind, something's either a book or it's software. It's an app, right? You're interacting with video content, or you're clicking around inside the quote-unquote, you know, book. Yeah. You're exploring the content. And even to a certain degree, right, when you're looking at an ebook and there's hyperlinks in it and there's contextual information, I mean, as soon as something becomes electronic, it's hard to call it just a traditional book, right? Because even on my Kindle, you know, I can do things on it that you can't do on a book. So, yeah, you know, it's someone just maybe trying to get a bit more attention, you know, for Google's book efforts, because certainly Amazon's the 1,250-pound gorilla in that space.
Yeah. John, any thoughts?
You know, I've seen a little bit of this. I use Xenio for magazines that I still read. And for a while, I had a subscription to Popular Mechanics. And so they were doing diagrams, you know, animations and things like that, which obviously are unprintable. But they were very nice for the magazine edition. I think it's a cool idea. I don't know if I would call it unprintable. I would call it maybe an enhanced book.
Mm-hmm. Which is what I think Apple called their books.
Oh, well, then I guess Google can't do that. Okay, call it. Let's go all Microsoft branding. Let's call it Enhanced with InfoSense Technology Book Consumer Personal Enterprise Ultimate Edition.
Yeah. 2016.
2016
indeed.
Preview.
Yeah.
Although to be fair, Microsoft's gotten a lot better. It's been quite a few years since they've done a really horrible, long, terrible name.
Yeah. On the enterprise side, I think they're still pretty good at that.
Yeah, the enterprise side.
Yeah, but you're right. Surface is a good branding, even though they had to appropriate it from a completely different product.
Yeah.
But that
but you don't know. Well. Surface actually stands for something on the enterprise side. Every letter spans out, you know, we just don't know the actual acronym.
And the next item I wanted to note is something called the Apple Error 53 controversy.
This is the opposite of all your heartwarming stories you just told me.
Yeah, exactly, right? As, you know, well, we're trying to be fair, right? So we'll sell the good and the bad. So apparently, if you go to a third party to get components fixed here, you know, basically a non-authorized dealer, I guess, to get your iPhone replaced, a recent update to iOS bricks your phone.
Well, and the story is that I've read is basically it's not just the third parties. It's not that you have to have some magical Apple sealant. It's just the third parties are using knockoff parts that are much cheaper. And when Apple does a verification check of the part signatures, it's not getting what it's expecting. And the people that are talking about this, the example from The Guardian was a home button replacement, which is obviously where the fingerprint scanner is on iOS. And I can understand Apple's point that you don't want counterfeit parts there because that's sort of where most of their security infrastructure for Apple Pay is. But at the same time, bricking is not the way to go. That's really kind of an extreme solution. I could see maybe, you know, disabling some functionality, disabling Apple Pay, disabling the fingerprint scanner, and then you have to go to an authorized service center to get it back up and running.
Yeah.
But yeah.
Yeah, that's. I think you're exactly right, John, that I understand why Apple's doing this because fundamentally when you start getting into, you know, biometric security and authentication, you know, it's this kind of secure pipeline of parts, right, that have to work together. And if somebody starts messing with that and putting in other parts, all of a sudden you have like an untrusted system. And then if you have an iPhone, you know, where you have authentication for Apple Pay, but somehow that chain of trust is broken, we're like, well, who's liable? You know, it's not going to be the guy in Macedonia that fixed your phone for $50, right? It's going to be someone else. But just like you said, clearly the logical thing to do is just simply disable the Touch ID sensor, right? Like lop off that chain, and so your iPhone can't be used for that kind of authentication anymore until it does get repaired. But yeah, bricking the phone, and you know, I read that Guardian article too, and Apple's response was a little. It was just a PR kind of response that didn't seem to understand that people rely on their phones so heavily. And like that one guy who was, you know, in like a war zone, he was like reporting from Afghanistan or something. And there's not an Apple store there to fix it. But it also begs the question, it's like, wow, if your phone is really that important to you, maybe you need to have a backup or maybe you need to not be so locked into this Apple ecosystem. Yeah. So I think that as users, people can have really unrealistic expectations sometimes and just expect that, you know, well, why won't Apple fix my phone when I'm in the middle of Afghanistan? It's like, well, you got to bear some responsibility yourself. You know?
It does remind me of whenever I traveled with Windows Otterbox. Mobile, I had a spare Windows Mobile device.
Yeah, me too.
I had a hot spare just in case. And the other thing with that I don't know, and Apple probably doesn't even release this, since iPhones are encrypted on device, that encryption key is only stored in one place. It might be stored in the same circuits that do Apple Pay, the same components. Yeah. So I could then see them saying, well, it's not just Apple Pay. It's kind of the whole device that's at risk. But at the same time, error 53 is a generic error that some programmer just threw onto it. And it's a little bit of overkill in this case.
Yeah, Apple clearly needs to think about a better way to do this. But that the iFixit quote, they said that the page that they have on this error has had 180,000 page views. So that's not a small number. Like this seems like it's not just a tiny edge case. It's, you know, maybe a significant issue for people and Apple. They need to have a better way to deal with this.
Yeah. Okay. The last two items are the recent articles I published over in extremetech.com. One is about this new Samsung Internet for Android browser. I bet you didn't know Samsung had their own browser for Android.
Not surprised. It probably involves using your eyeballs somehow.
I think it's based on Firefox. And what they did is they added content blocking, in which iOS users have had, at least those of you with 64-bit iOS devices, have had since iOS 9. I think you have to... You have to, like, what the equivalent of jailbreaking Android phone to do that on the Chrome side, I think. Not quite sure. But you can download, like, the Adblock browser free from the Google Play Store if you want to do some, you know, content management. And the second one is something I'm waiting for, and that's Android Wear 1.4. Gosh, there was one thing I... There are the three new features, one of which I can't use because I don't have a speaker built into my first-gen Moto 360. But the gestures, I don't know. I guess if you're running through an airport, it might be useful, and I will be running through an airport in not too distant future. Yeah, so that's kind of interesting. Well, we'll see.
One of those gestures, I hear the rumor is that if you flip off someone at the airport, it just tweets out, "I'm very angry at,"
Yeah.
That would be a good use of gestures.
That reminds me, before we sign off, Jason, are you using any wearables these days?
You know, it's funny, right? I haven't worn a watch in 20 years. I don't wear watches. I find them very uncomfortable. So the whole idea of a wearable to me is it doesn't work for me. But I'm also open to the fact that this may be like me in tablets. It may not be something that I fully kind of appreciate until I wear one. Mm-hmm. I did have a Pebble smartwatch that I wore for a little while. It was someone else at HTC was testing it, and I got it to kind of test it. And I used it for maybe about a week, and then the Bluetooth sync broke on it. I couldn't get it to work again, and then it's just I gave it back to them. So wearables could be something that I eventually get into, but even from the point of like a fitness tracker, I find fitness trackers interesting because I would love to know the percentage of people that actually it modifies their behavior, you know, whether or not a fitness tracker just reinforces what you already know, or if it actually makes you know, the whole gamification, I need to go for a walk to hit my 10,000 steps. You know, I would love to know if there's any, you know, data out there that actually talks about if it shapes behaviors.
John's actually doing research on that now, I think.
Yeah, I'll have a little bit of fitness tracker data, but what the fitness tracker wasn't what the manipulation was that we were looking for. We just happened to use a fitness tracker to get some of the variables that we were hoping to manipulate in other ways. So, I can tell you, knowing I haven't looked up too much data on it, but I don't find any compelling data that fitness trackers are changing behavior unless you're using them as part of a larger, larger push to change your behavior, and you're using
it's state. One of the things like altering your diet or whatever.
This isn't going to do anything. Yeah.
You know, John and I had this discussion a couple of weeks ago, Jason. An article came out about somebody was ranting and railing about fitness tracking type devices, because I think she said something like it makes it seem like work. And I told John, you know, I've been using a Fitbit for, I forget what I told you now, John, maybe 5-6 years. It's been a long time since it came out, the first Fitbit. And I'm on my third one now. Not because I lost them, by the way, because I've upgraded. And it's been great. You know, I really enjoy knowing how much of what I do. And last night, I don't consider it work, but, you know, I will say, last night I happened to look at my Fitbit before I was about to go to sleep. I noticed I had only done 9 flights of stairs. And I said, oh, my target every day is 10. So I went down, came back up. My 10 flights.
Well, it's funny because I have it's called a Sense, and it's a sleep tracker. It was a Kickstarter or Indiegogo. I don't know. I had this spree where I backed like 30 things in a span of 6 months. I had a bit of an addiction with Kickstarter, Indiegogo projects. But it is interesting because I look at the data almost every day, and I look at it, and it definitely does shape some of my sleeping patterns, insofar as I know that, you know, boy, you know, I should really, you know, get to bed lights out before 10. Right. And it's interesting to know, you know, how long does it take me to fall asleep? You know, I always thought, oh, it takes me like an hour to fall asleep. Oh, it only takes me 15 minutes to fall asleep. Yeah. That's pretty interesting. So, you know, I think that data can shape our lives, but it also depends just on your own personality. You know, some people don't like changing, but like you said, if it's a reminder to do something that you already feel predisposed to do, then the data can give you that extra nudge. Mm-hmm. But I'm not sure, again, how many people really feel that way.
Yeah. Okay. Well, hey, Jason, it has been a pleasure to talk to you again. We haven't spoken in person in a long, like years, I think.
Although it's been a while.
Email and stuff. So it's great to actually see you. I know we don't record the video on these things, but I can see Jason as well as John, and I'm apparently the only person with not growing a beard these days. But anyway,
yeah, you are. And Jason, it was good talking to you. I haven't talked to you since Monday, so it's been a long time.
That's right. Well, if I'm ever on again, we'll have to talk about ad blocking, because you didn't see the steam coming out of my ears when you started talking about that. But that is a topic near and dear to my heart, but it takes a bit of time to unpack that rant ball.
Okay. Anyway, this has been Mobile Views Podcast number 148. Todd Ugasore, Jason Dunn, our special guest, and of course, my good friend John Westfall, my regular co-host. We will talk to you next time.